KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We get older, but the cast stay the same age, to paraphrase Matthew McConaughey. And so now we're working with actors who were not necessarily born when Gossip Girl first premiered, or OC first premiered, or were quite young then. So they want to know what the aughts were like.
Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage created The OC and Gossip Girl, some of the most defining young adult shows of the early 2000s. As they continue to make shows about young adult angst, they also confront the passage of time. Savage and Schwartz tell us about their new series, Looking for Alaska, a coming-of-age story set in the ancient days of 2005. They first dreamed of a film adaptation of John Green's novel of the same name 14 years ago. They tell us how they finally managed to turn it into a limited series on Hulu. The team behind The CW's Nancy Drew and an upcoming Gossip Girl remake for HBO Max also explains why they actually shrank their production company. But first on the news banter, Rose McGowan sues Harvey Weinstein and Lisa Bloom and a whole bunch of others. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt. So, Rose McGowan has now sued Harvey Weinstein, and she, of course, has alleged for some time that he raped her, and she's among many women who have alleged that he assaulted them. She's also naming David Boies, his lawyer, advisor, slash enabler, and Lisa Bloom, a supposed women's rights lawyer who became another Harvey enabler, tried to help him launder his terrible reputation. She's suing them. She's claiming that they engaged in a racketeering, wiretap violations, all kinds of stuff. She's also suing Black Cube, which was the intelligence agency that was hired to pursue Ronan Farrow and apparently her. So she is making all these allegations. I'm going to focus on one detail because I had, you know, spent a lot of time, as you know, writing about Roy Price, who is the head of Amazon Studios and alleged misconduct. And in this lawsuit, she alleges that Roy Price bought a screenplay that she had written. This is in 2016, so it's about a year before Harvey is finally the subject of exposés in The New Yorker and New York Times. She says he bought this screenplay from her. She then found out that Harvey was doing a huge deal with Roy Price and Amazon, which Harvey desperately needed. The Weinstein Company was in trouble. She goes to Roy Price and says, "This guy raped me." Roy Price responds, "That's not proven." And then she finds out that her project is killed. And what she is saying in this litigation is, "This guy did this to help out Harvey. He wanted to know what was in my project. He wanted to see if there was anything that would be detrimental to him. He wanted to silence me." And certainly this does appear to be the kind of back-scratching arrangement among a certain type of man that does silence women, because there was some reciprocity, not just this huge deal that Roy gave Harvey, but Harvey did favors for Roy.
Yeah, and it looks here like this was an effort to bring Rose into the tent, so to speak. And it's what Harvey did with Lisa Bloom. The first move that Harvey made on Lisa Bloom was to option her book to develop into a film project. And all of a sudden, you know, a few months later, Lisa Bloom is then representing Harvey Weinstein and leveraging her reputation as a women's rights advocate to protect this alleged serial predator. And obviously it blew up in both of their faces. But this seemed to be the tactic. And it just goes to the overall level of effort that Harvey Weinstein put into keeping his behavior secret. I mean, if you read this Ronan Farrow book, especially, the lengths to which he went were extraordinary. There was a Black Cube operative whose job was to befriend Rose McGowan and be integrated into her life. And all of a sudden, Rose is disclosing things to her and showing her portions of the book. And this operative is going directly back to Harvey Weinstein. Now, whether this rises to the level of a civil action and something that she can collect damages on, we'll see. There's this now litigation over this. But the tactics were extraordinary and just reprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, just bringing it back to Roy Price, he bought Rose McGowan's screenplay, and after Roy tried to set up his girlfriend at Amazon with a deal, which he was told, for, you know, you can't do this, Harvey bought it. And we reported on this. And the response from the Weinstein Company is like, oh, this person is a talent that we've been following for some time, which was not exactly credible. I mean, this woman did not have an array of credits that would have necessarily caught the attention of the Weinstein Company. So this is a catch and kill with favors being done. And it really is an example of how this stuff works. Now, I will note that Harvey's lawyer, Phyllis Kupferstein, sent us at The Hollywood Reporter a statement. Once and for all, Rose McGowan will be shown to be what she is, a publicity seeker looking for money from the moment she sought a multi-million dollar payout in return for not making these baseless allegations, which we rejected. We knew she was waiting for an opportune time to begin this. I mean, I don't know what else they can say. Very aggressive. But I imagine that maybe Phyllis Kupferstein is getting some cards and letters from people who feel that trashing Rose McGowan in this context is not the best look. Meanwhile, moving back to, you know, our new almost favorite subject, streaming wars. Turns out, Matt, I am a Disney Plus subscriber, apparently, even though I've done nothing because I have Verizon.
Yeah, Disney made a big deal or announced a big deal this past week where Disney Plus is going to be available for free to Verizon customers. And this is going to give a huge advantage. It's going to be a pre-installed user base for this new streaming service that they are launching on November 12th. And it's really a smart move, in my opinion, because all that matters to Disney is that they can achieve some scale, and they're never going to catch Netflix, but bring up their subscriber base to a number that is respectable where they can start making money off of it. And this is a good start.
I don't know, this idea that they'll never catch Netflix. I mean, I know Netflix has a huge subscriber base, but I have to say, you know, I saw an ad for Disney Plus, and it was quite attention grabbing. I mean, they have this insane amount of intellectual property. And I was looking at that ad and thinking, you know, people are going to do this. It's $7 a month, even if they don't have Verizon, in which case it's free for a year. The estimates I've seen that they'll get this many million in the first year seem very conservative to me. I don't see how you pass it up, especially if you have kids.
There were some interesting analyst reports this past week when the Verizon deal was announced, where the analysts are now upping the forecast of Disney Plus subscribers. Disney has said that they want between 60 and 90 million subscribers by 2024, and they're willing to sacrifice billions of dollars in television revenue that they are now going to be pushing in these licensing deals to the Disney Plus service. And the analysts are now saying that they expect Disney, thanks to this deal, to have about 18 million subscribers by the end of 2020, which would be ahead of some of these forecasts and give a good start on getting up to those lofty numbers after the first 5 years.
Meanwhile, Matt Zoller-Zeitz published in Vulture a sort of a cri de coeur about Disney putting classic Fox movies in its vault that people normally might rent and play in theaters. You know, old titles, they have a ton of them. I mean, we're talking about things like Alien, The Princess Bride, Moulin Rouge, all these old titles, and much older, of course. Things like Miracle on 34th Street and All About Eve, classic movies in some cases. And I will quote Mark Harris. He's a pop culture critic and film writer. He tweeted, "This is particularly important because Disney post-Fox acquisition is essentially a double-sized studio, by far the biggest in America in terms of revenue. What it's doing via this policy is suppressing a vast swath of film history that is not even its own." I'm sure Disney is going to have to sort this out, and maybe they haven't been able to process and digest. But on the other hand, they do have these streaming services, and it wouldn't surprise anyone if they paid all this money for Fox and hoarded classic movies.
Well, a bit of good news. The one movie they are not stopping from being shown is Rocky Horror Picture Show. So you can continue, Kim, to have your Saturday nights
those
booked
midnight
up for the
screenings. Yeah.
for the foreseeable future.
Yes, thank God for that. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new Hulu series, Looking for Alaska, follows the coming of age of Miles, a morose teenager who convinces his parents to send him to Culver Creek, a boarding school that looks a lot like a rustic summer camp in the woods of Alabama. Just after stepping out of the shower at his new school, Miles, played by Charlie Plummer, meets his gregarious new roommate, played by Denny Love.
Name's Chip, Chip Martin. We'll shake your hand, but I think it's best if you just hang on to that towel.
I'm Miles. Miles Halter.
Miles, as in, to go before I sleep. It's a Robert Frost poem. Ever read him?
No.
Consider yourself lucky.
I beg to differ, but be that as it may, Miles soon meets and, of course, falls for his mysterious fellow student, Alaska Young. Friendships, romances, pranks, and drama soon follow. The Looking for Alaska Hulu series comes from Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage. Since first meeting more than 15 years ago, the two have been prolific. Their series include Gossip Girl, Heart of Dixie, Runaways, and this year's Nancy Drew series on the CW. It all started in 2003 with a little show called The OC. Well, you were the youngest showrunner in history.
That's what they say.
You were 26.
I've never actually gone into the Guinness Book of World Records.
I did.
Oh, you did? I don't know if it's in there.
Was he the youngest?
Of a drama, yes.
Wow.
There may be someone younger who created a comedy.
Ooh.
I only looked at drama.
Okay.
And so you two, where did you two kids meet?
We were kids. We met on it was a general meeting. Stephanie was partners with the director McGee, and we met on a general meeting. I just met with Steph. She threw out the idea of Orange County, which was where McGee was from. So they were looking to develop something in that, something, anything in that world. And I had gone to USC, which is a direct pipeline from Newport Beach directly into the halls of the hallowed halls of USC as a Jewish kid from the East Coast. And so I had kind of a take on those Orange County kids. So I came back to Steph with some ideas and we just started talking about it. And it was a relationship. It was a working relationship for me as a writer that I had never had with a producer or development executive, where it was just a seamless, it was a conversation. And out of that conversation, characters and scenes were just starting to happen. And I was like, I've never had this experience with a producer before. I think you're a writer. And you had been writing
know?
On the side.
Was this news to you?
It wasn't news. If you asked my mom, she'd be like, the weird thing is that she was ever a producer because, you know, I'd grown up writing. I wrote a short story collection.
You had a zine.
I had many zines in the 90s.
Most dedicated to Kurt Cobain or River Phoenix.
Exactly. But growing up in Canada,
heartbreak.
Possibly being a girl, never really thought that like, oh, I'm just going to make things. I was going to University of Iowa to get my PhD in film history and theory. And I came out here to do research for my dissertation. And I had a scholarship that at the time seemed like this incredible amount of money. But when I realized how far that would go in Los Angeles, I had to get a job, and I ended up working at Drew Barrymore's company, Flower Films. She and Nancy Javonin had just formed it. So I worked there for 5 years, and that's when I met McGee and did not finish my dissertation.
I was going to say, the
while
academics
I was working
were like
on the first Charlie's Angels movie, and then went and formed Wonderland with McGee, and we did the second movie.
So weird. And now we have another Charlie's Angels movie.
There's been a TV show in between. So anyway, so Steph and I had this really fluid working relationship where she was my boss. And when I finished the pilot, I didn't want to hand it in. I was like, this is not good. And she's like, I'm driving to your house, and taking it out of your hands. The show went really quickly. They wanted it on the air in August. So we were making the pilot while we had a writer's room going. And that's how we ended up doing 27 episodes.
Making a sizzle reel while we were also making the pilot. They picked it up on the last day of production.
It was
insane.
It was very fast. So we were thrown into the deep end together and we forged this dynamic. And then at a certain point, I was like, you should write an episode. And she did and did was the first Chris Mac episode, did a great job. And our roles reversed and suddenly I got to be.
I'm the baby writer and I don't want to hand my script into the showrunner because what if it's not good and he doesn't like it?
And then eventually was like, come do this full time. And so she did. And then when the show ended, I got sent the Gossip Girl books and said to Steph, I think we should do this together.
And then Chuck went at exactly the same time.
Yeah, I was doing Chuck with a USC colleague, Chris Fedak, and that was happening simultaneously with Gossip Girl. And then they both ended up airing opposite each other.
Oh, the audience. I didn't know
that. Very different audiences, but yeah. And then both shows premiered and then the writer strike happened.
Right. And then the only show I think I read that came back was Gossip Girl?
That same year. So the writer strike happened. Everybody's shows got pulled off the air. And then because the CW just didn't have enough stuff to air for that long, everybody, I think NBC started running like American Gladiators. They had enough that they could just kind of put out there.
But new stuff.
But new stuff. And the CW didn't. So they actually needed Gossip Girl to come back on the air after the strike.
And they also re-aired Gossip Girl over and over again during the strike.
And that actually ended up being the best thing for the show. So when the show came back in January, there was a new marketing campaign and that worked out. And then Chuck came back the following fall.
So both of them actually kind of survived.
They did. Yeah. Three shows survived from 2007 fall.
Pre-strike, yes.
Yeah, it was
Chuck, Gossip Girl.
And a little show called The Big Bang Theory.
Heard of it.
Yeah. And then a year or two later, we started our company.
And nobody was anybody's boss.
Exactly. Stephanie's still kind of my boss. I definitely still answer to Stephanie.
Perspective here. But I don't know how you manage your lives. CBS deal for broadcasting, Apple deal for whatever that, streaming.
Mm-hmm.
But just first look, if they don't want it, you go somewhere else.
Exactly.
How many shows do you have right now?
Four shows and then Gossip Girl, the reboot, The Room has started.
The room has started. Mm-hmm. This will be important news. I have a daughter who she thinks Gossip Girl is awesome and new and
great.
And you get like approached by people, right? Like they want to talk to you about Gossip Girl.
Yeah, we've found that there's a new generation of viewers who've discovered Gossip Girl on Netflix or the OC on Hulu. Some of the cast that we work with, because we continue to work with, we get older, but the cast stay the same age, to paraphrase Matthew McConaughey. And so now we're working with actors who were not necessarily born when Gossip Girl first premiered or OC first premiered or were quite young then. So they want to know what the aughts were like. So we get to be
what were the aughts like? Yeah. That is so depressing. Do you make them go back and just watch the whole thing?
We're grateful that they're watching. Yeah. I mean, we don't make them. No, it's not like required viewing. It was very funny though, because Christine Froseth, who plays Alaska in Looking for Alaska, told us after she got cast that she had watched the OC from beginning to end about 5 times.
Wow.
And then she made Charlie Plummer, her co-star, start watching the show as well. And she's like, we just have to watch up until Marissa dies. Charlie goes,
spoiler
Marissa
who haven't started yet.
Yeah, exactly. 14-year spoiler. And Charlie was like, Marissa dies? She was like, oh my God. So anyway, it's very fun to revisit those shows with these new viewers.
So I'm interested in this transition that I read, and maybe this is something you don't want to quite say, or maybe you do, because you still have a broadcast deal, right? Mm-hmm. But you were sort of like, you have talked about being like, I am somewhat done with that format, with taking notes, I think you said.
Well, one is never done taking notes.
From network executives.
That too. But I think we're putting that out in the universe to see if we can get less notes, but it hasn't worked so far. This is the broadcast model for ourselves as writers and showrunners for shows that we create and run ourselves. You know, we did 10 years between the OC, Gossip Girl, Chuck of broadcast shows.
Right.
So when we got to the end of that, we were sort of like, I think for us, if we're going to do something for broadcast, we would love to do it with another writer who we can create something together, and then they can take the day-to-day of the 22-episode marathon run. And we were really interested in making that transition as showrunners into the 10-episode, 13-episode, in the case of Alaska, 8-episode format.
Now, of course, that's not where the pot of gold comes from. Like, the pot of gold was always 100 episodes, syndication. Mm-hmm. This transition, the digital thing has been underway and anticipated for so long. And now it's really, really here. And for you, do you feel like, well, we had our broadcast run, so we're cool with it? Or do you feel like, what happened to my pot of gold? Extra pot of gold.
Extra pot of gold. Yeah, I mean, we're not going to complain about how things have gone for us. But I think the place we got to was, our company got pretty big, and we were in an overall deal at ABC Studios at the time. And we just found that we were selling a lot of shows and things. We were getting further and further from touching things as writers ourselves. And we made the decision a few years ago to go independent, not have an overall deal, and shrink our company and really try to, even if we weren't the showrunner of that show, have it be a show that we feel like we could have written and touched. So we really wanted to kind of bet on ourselves. It meant smaller volume, in the hopes that if the shows are good, success will follow. There will be some form of reward for that.
Right.
And some of that was driven by changes in the marketplace, and some of it was just driven by exhaustion. And
right.
Like, maybe if we just had taken a 6-month vacation, like, we would have made a different choice on the other side. Yeah.
But you didn't.
But kind of moving away from being writers and feeling like that was the right choice for us at the time, and then realizing that
we actually are writers
and we were in business and competitive with a lot of non-writing producers for material and other writers. And then we were like, wait, we are writers. Like, we could do this ourselves.
Why are we doing this?
Yeah, we don't have to be in this other business in the same way that we were.
Yeah, I'm looking at this other interview. You said you had offices at Paramount for movies. Mm-hmm. You had an office at Disney, 3 executives, 4 or 5 assistants, 9 people. It just was like, what you're talking about, it's just, what are we doing? We're overextended and we're not having as much fun.
Yeah, and honestly, we don't like that part of the managing personnel and having staff meetings and flow charts and people coming in and you talking about their performance assessments.
We don't even know what it's called.
Yeah,
that's how bad we were
called.
At managing.
Yeah. So either we like embrace that and like go on some MBA seminars to learn how to run companies, or we just don't do that and do what we love to do.
Coming up, Stephanie Savage and Josh Schwartz talk about key changes they made when adapting John Green's novel Looking for Alaska for Hulu, and why they got a TV MA rating, even though there's not much sex. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Stephanie Savage and Josh Schwartz, executive producers of the limited series Looking for Alaska, now on Hulu. Based on a John Green novel of the same name, Looking for Alaska follows Miles, a sullen teen who has something of an awakening when he arrives at a boarding school in rural Alabama in 2005. Miles, played by Charlie Plummer, is a kid who doesn't know much, but he's obsessed with the last words of famous people. When he meets the book-loving Alaska, played by Christine Froseth, she fills him in on her favorite last words.
The general in his labyrinth, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's about Simon Bolivar. In the book, you know what his last words are. He was shaken by the overwhelming revelation that the headlong race between his misfortunes and his dreams was at that moment reaching the finish line. Damn it, he sighed. How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?
Those are some seriously great last words.
Schwartz and Savage originally intended to make Looking for Alaska into a movie, though that was 14 years ago, before streaming services. Obviously, Looking for Alaska's eventual home, Hulu, didn't even exist. Something else they couldn't have predicted 14 years ago? That Disney would buy Fox, giving it a majority stake in Hulu. This experience with the streamer, with Hulu, you started, I'm assuming, as it had to be, before Disney took control
yes.
of that.
Mm-hmm. And they had a piece of it when we started with Runaways.
Right, but that was way different.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for Alaska has been a controversial book for young adults because of the content, because of sex, because of drugs. There's a lot of smoking, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge thing for their film studio chairman, Alan Horn. He hates depictions of smoking. He's not running Hulu, but I wonder whether there's none of that filtering in, or you were already through the process before they could have filtered in.
We were through the process. We talked about it with Hulu. I mean, they had their concerns. The show's rated TVMA. So that
and
was,
that's because of smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, that was part of the trade-off.
Really? Mm-hmm. Just the cigarettes? The sex was fine?
There's
implied more than shown. Right?
Yeah.
It's not graphic in any way. But, you know, and the show deals with pretty heavy themes as well. And that was really what our focus was on, the sort of the emotional lives of the characters. It's definitely, for the teen shows we've done, it's probably the least salacious.
Really? That's sort of interesting. So this thing was in gestation for how many years? 15 years?
It's been a long road. It's been 14 years, yeah.
You read the book pre-publication.
Yeah, I got it in galley form. It was mid-OC run. Fell in love with the book, fell in love with John's writing, and set it up as a feature at Paramount. Stephanie and I were working together on the OC. We had not yet formed our company. So she's been living with every draft of the feature along with me. And just couldn't get it made.
I'm looking for a facial expression on Stephanie. It's
yep.
a slight little look, but
that's a look. But just could not get it made at the studio. And there was numerous drafts. And,
As a movie.
And so then there was multiple executives we were dealing with and multiple drafts. But in the studio's defense, which is not something I often say.
Really?
But it's not a high concept story. It's not an obvious studio movie. It does deal with some heavier themes. And I can understand why it was a tricky movie for a studio to make.
But it was also, I would say, like when Josh set that up, it was kind of at the last moment when it seemed remotely possible to make a book like that as a movie. And then we
it's
were
really
just living.
Possible.
Now
yeah.
it's really not possible. And we're living with those changes.
But it worked out for the best, because I do think an 8-episode limited series ended up being the best approach for the story.
No, I have to. I mean, I feel like, yeah, I think in a way it got born when its time was, however frustrating.
That's exactly as we planned it. We really,
yeah,
really,
yeah.
really,
really, really. So really. Clever. You said there's going to be this digital revolution.
Yeah.
But when we started working together, I had always loved miniseries growing up, and the idea that the world stopped and everyone was just watching.
Roots. Yeah.
Yeah. And then sitting down with Peter Roth very seriously and
at
being
Warner
like
Brothers,
a Warner
is.
Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Miniseries. And Peter was just like, I love you. Like, that's such a wonderful idea. And it's so true. And I remember those times. But we're never doing that. There's no revenue stream. There's no way to program them. They don't make any money. Like, we're not doing that. So it took 15 years to have
Stephanie's
streaming.
Often right, 14 years ahead of people.
Right,
I've learned.
It's very
right
frustrating. At the wrong time.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It's very frustrating to be right when people don't hear that rightness. So you did make some changes. You changed the character of the colonel, mm-hmm. his race. The character in the book is white, but changing it to an African-American, I don't know if it was in the movie, if you changed it to...
It wasn't changed in the movie, but it was a conversation with our writer's room and wanting to have a cast that reflected the diversity of our writer's room. And also when Denny Love, who plays the colonel, walked into the room for his audition, it was just, he was so undeniable, so charismatic, so funny, so the colonel, that it really cemented that decision.
And then it created storyline material
yes. yeah.
for you. I assume John Green sits there. At one point, he ran off with some other possible filmmakers. He cheated on you a little.
Well, in his defense, he was probably like, guys, it's been 10 years.
It's enough. Yeah. I let you try.
And it may have been the studio's that thought, not his. But that version that almost got made without us, they got very close. That was heartbreaking, I have to say. Because, you know, you work in this business.
Right.
You're used to things not working out and you have to move on. I personally just could not move on. So if I overheard somebody talking about the movie, like my ears would turn red. I would get all flushed. It was very
like
emotional.
Somebody else is making
Yeah, exactly. So I reached out to a couple years ago about this idea of doing it as a limited series and creating a more immersive experience for the audience that you get to spend 8 hours with these characters instead of just trying to compress everything into 2 hours. So he's been enormously generous with his time. He took us to his school, the real life school that he went to.
Yeah.
He took the cast there as well. And so he's been a great sort of source of inspiration and also giving us, you know, his approval and giving everyone the confidence to move forward with the story.
So the changes didn't...
No, the things he was actually most excited about in the adaptation were everything that was new. And so we would send him every draft and we would get notes back from him being like, I'm just not sure about this line. We're like, John, that's your line. Like, well, I don't like it.
Why did I write that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's been a long time since he wrote the book as well.
Yeah, it was his first book. So I think even as a writer himself, there may have been things that he would do differently if he was writing it now. And the fact that he had some distance probably gave him more openness to change. And also knowing that we talked a lot before we started, because some of it was going to be adaptation, some of it was going to be bringing things to life that are alluded to but aren't really on the page, making them on screen. And then other things were going to be pure invention. And we talked him through all of that. And he understood if we were going to make it 8 hours long, and one of our intentions in doing that is really building out the supporting characters and everything is not seen through Miles's point of view, especially Alaska, that was going to make it different than the book.
So he was like, okay. Because you don't want the author to say, this is not my work.
Especially an author like John, who has such a close relationship with his readers.
Readers,
and his fans.
Yeah. So you actually met the Apple people when you were pitching this, and they did want to buy it, right? They were interested.
Yeah. But it was 18 months ago.
Yeah, Apple.
We just didn't know.
It's 18 months later. I'll say it. You don't have to say anything. It's just like we're still watching and saying, how is this going
to
go?
Well, I mean, we're very excited to be working
now
with
that you have a deal there. It's going to go great.
but 18 months ago, we just didn't know enough about what the company was or when it was going to be open for business, when those shows were going to be available. And we had been trying to make this for 14 years, and we really wanted to take that opportunity to go make it now. And we had a show with Hulu, so that was a very natural evolution to have it land there. But now that we do know what Apple is all about, we are extremely excited to get started.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to say, you guys, the cornucopia of ideas that seem to flow from or through you guys, I don't even know. Do you just sit there day and night and go, I know this, I know that? No?
I mean, that is what I will say that's fun about having a partner is that we can bounce ideas off each other and we do enjoy that.
Yeah.
That's fun. And we are fortunate that, you know, that Runaways was like my favorite comic and we got to work on that. Stephanie read every Nancy Drew book when she was a girl. Now we get to work on that.
And really looking for that Venn diagram where our passions overlap and one person might like something a little bit more than the other person or be more connected to it through childhood or what have you, but that the other person also really loves it and can find something in it for themselves.
Jewish kid from the East Coast, Canadian woman from
somewhere Alberta.
Alberta. I can see the connection, absolutely.
By the way, our birthdays are one day apart, so it might be a Leo thing.
Okay, it's a Leo thing. Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage are the executive producers of Looking for Alaska, now on Hulu. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.